This episode of The Review was first broadcast on the 10th of March 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review live from Studio One here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Gillian Tobias.
Coming up on today's programme, we'll find out what the booksellers are seeing disappear from their shelves in independent bookshops in Madrid, Beijing and Mumbai.
We want to create an ambience where people can come and enjoy books without distractions to get a feeling of chain, which is Urdu word for something which gives you absolute peace.
We'll also be listening to some new music, courtesy of Joan Luna, editor of Mondo Sonoro, a Spanish music magazine.
And we'll be flicking through the pages of our favourite magazines with Chris Ying, editor of Lucky Peach magazine.
All this right here on The Review on Monocle 24.
Happy Saturday, Andrew.
Happy Saturday to you. I've got a weekend here, you know. I'm coming back in tomorrow as well.
Oh, Andrew, I was hoping, because you have a heavy week next week, I was hoping this would be your
I don't mind. Off. It's a treat. It's a treat. Always been Paul Noble as well, on the other side of the glass. As long as I've made him come in to be the executive producer, I don't mind. And he's had a bit of a beardy shave off this morning as well. He's even dressed for Saturday, which is kind of reverse of anybody else.
I know.
Anybody else would be kind of like dapper all week and then, you know, slumming at the weekend. He's always dapper in the week, but he's even more dapper on a Saturday.
There's a sense of occasion when we do the review, Andrew.
I know, and I'm very glad to see you in your ball gown. You look very good.
Tiara next week.
Have you had a good week in Midori House?
I have had a good week in Midori House, and now I have all my sort of action list of things that I want to do for my weekend of reading and film going and before the next week starts.
So we put a couple of good films up this week as well, didn't we? We put up the Sheep film.
We did put
I
up
call
the
it
sheep
the Sheep film.
I know, we are all calling it the Sheep film or the Bar film. But that was a lovely one because it coincided with the issue of the magazine, but it's a way we can do film in a different way from print. And
So this is the story of merino wool, isn't it, in Australia, and how it's become one of the most kind of sought-after products in China and how that's kind of helping Australia's sheep farmers.
Yeah, and so we just talk, we go and talk to the farmers themselves who
I think I said,
you know,
go and
are
talk
passionate
to sheep.
About their sheep, but also they're very savvy to obviously the business side of it, and it's just a nice way of telling the business story.
And what else did we get up this week? We've recorded the promotion for the next issue.
Drum roll. Listen out the promo for the next issue, yes. Which is exciting because the magazine comes to
because our subscribers subscribe at monocle.com. Our subscribers will be getting their early issues very soon because we post them to them first. There's another reason to subscribe. But the new issue is on newsstand on Thursday.
And it has a great cover. I have to say this is one of my favourite.
Yes, we sent Sophie Grove, our lovely editor, all the way to we did a Parliament special, and she went up to meet the Sami people in the high north of Europe. And she went to two of their parliaments. But then the next day we put her on a plane to Addis Ababa to go and see the new parliament for the African Union.
And then in a very short time she's off to she went to Cannes as well. She does get some fun assignments.
Well, we're going to be talking more magazines, more books and more music.
You're listening to Monocle 24. Well, we start the show today, as ever, with a trio of bookshops from around the world to hear what's selling well this past week.
First up, we visit Cardi Hughes in Beijing.
The Bookworm is a really valuable community resource here in Beijing. It's a place to have a cup of coffee, hear intellectuals talking about Chinese economy, Chinese business, hearing international authors talk on their work, and just a really great meeting place for people to come together to share ideas and discussions. Hi, my name is Katie Hughes, and I am the events programmer here at the Bookworm in Beijing. I'm also the director of the Beijing International Literary Festival. Alex Pearson founded the Bookworm in 2006. The Bookworm is in Sanlitun, which is a more international neighborhood in Beijing. There's international stores around here, but there also is still bits of old Beijing, little hutongs and noodle shops and things like that. For the most part, we're probably 60% international, 40% Chinese who come here. There are students, there are teachers, there are people on expat packages, there's lots of people who work for embassies, a lot of people who work in media. And then, there are lots of people who are here writing the great expat novel on their MacBook in the cafe. When you first walk into the Bookworm, what you come into is sort of the main bar restaurant space. I love it because there's so much open air, and it's really high vaulted ceilings. We have a lot of light and glass windows all around, and we hang lanterns from the ceiling for our literary festival, but then we also hang floating lights the year round. So it's really wonderful when you walk up to the book room, you can sort of see this really great visual before you even get here. This room is the largest room in the bookworm, but during the festival and during events, we turn this into theater seating, and this is where we have all our book talks. We have really amazing Chinese and international authors, and you get to sit in a room with 100 people and listen to them. This room back here is our bookshop. We have great fiction that we spend a lot of time carefully curating. We do carry a few Chinese language titles, but mainly English language, and we have a very large China section. The first thing you'll see when you come to the China book section is how almost all the books are red. It's sort of the telltale sign that you are now in the China section. One of the books that's very popular is China in 10 Words by Yu Hua. He writes in Chinese, but a lot of his work has been translated into English, as well as adapted into film. He usually writes fiction. China in 10 Words is nonfiction, and it's 10 chapters, and each chapter looks at a different concept in Chinese that is sort of very indicative and evocative of contemporary culture right now. Today, actually, we are launching the Bookworm International Literary Festival 2012. So opening night is tonight. It's a big buzz around here of us final preparations. The festival runs for 2 weeks in Beijing, Suzhou, and Chengdu. The events are all in English or Chinese with English translation. And it's a really international group of people. We have a children's program every morning for kids. We have writing workshops. This year, we have lots of performance poetry and music and hip hop and a one-man show with a really great Scottish playwright. So it's a really diverse and wonderful lineup that we're really excited and proud to be sharing with everyone.
And that was Cardi Hughes from the Bookworm in Beijing. It sounds exhausting working there. Oh my God, how many things I've got going on. I thought a nice thing about a book was you could put your feet up.
No, and I love the sound effects they use, the click, click, clink of the footsteps, like that's the sound of an independent bookstore. But.
Yeah, and China in 10 Words. Now, I could write the British equivalent of that. That's about as many words as I could probably fit into a book, I think.
I love colour-coding cities, you know, red obviously for China, thinking of all the other colours.
Yeah, it's funny how many Chinese books do have red covers, and actually how many products now, when you see actually companies trying to sell things to China, they think, oh God, it's got to be red.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the way forward.
The graphic designer plate.
And the other thing I liked was the fact that the cafe is full of people writing the great expat novel. That sounds like a lot of horrible literature coming our way over the next couple of years.
They'll all be at the festival that they're hosting.
Yes, well, gosh, there's a reason not to go. Anyway, okay, where should we go next?
Let's head to Madrid next, Andrew, and we'll visit Tipos Infames.
We are here at Tipos Infames, in an independent bookshop in the center of Madrid, in Malasaña. I'm Magda Anglès. I work for Tipos Infames. We are launching a book. That is why there is so much noise today. Javier Gutiérrez has launched his first novel. He was a customer from the beginning when we started 1 year ago in 2012. And he really wanted to launch his book here. And this is what we are doing now. And this week we have Mata tus ídolos by Luc Sante. The original title is Killing Your Darlings. It's published by Libros del Cao, that it's an independent publisher that has its third book. So the publishers are just beginning, but we are really supporting this book. It's a very interesting compilation of essays on underground culture. We also have Locus Solus by Raymond Roussel, published by Captain Swing. Raymond Roussel was a surrealist writer, and he was very influential. And here we couldn't, it was very difficult to find a translation. And Reina Sofía has just inaugurated an exhibition, and Captain Swing took advantage and find a new translation, and it's very interesting, and you can find this here at Tipos Infames. There is also Javier Montes, La Vida de Hotel, published by Anagrama. Javier Montes is an art critic, but also he has been selected by Granta as one of the prominent young writers, and we are happy to have him as well. This month we're really looking forward for this. We have a monthly event that we invite authors to be the booksellers, and it's a way to get in contact readers with their favorite writers. And this week we have Marcos Giral Torrente. He won the National Fiction Award this past year, and he will be talking with the readers and selling his favorite books to his fans. Let's put it that way. We also have we select the publisher of the month, and we do some events related to their books and what they are looking for, and we make some events related to this.
I'm not sure how much reading goes on in that bookstore. It was a lot of coffee going on. There were a lot of chinking of cups, unless Mr. Aldous kind of dragged the young lady away somewhere for a coffee. I don't know.
I think they're looking for lively bookstores.
But it's good always that whenever you go to kind of Spanish bookstores, you know, surrealism is still selling well. You know, that they love surrealism.
Where to next?
We'll crank the globe and we'll head to Mumbai to visit the Kitab Khana bookstore.
Hi, my name is Amrita Somaya. My shop is Kitab Khana, and it's located in the heart of Mumbai in the Heritage District. Our building is also a 100-year-old building, and it has beautiful columns, and the ambience is very well restored. We want to create an ambience where people can come and enjoy books without distractions, to get a feeling of chain, which is Urdu word for it's undescribable, actually, something which gives you absolute peace. Apart from these, we also have book clubs for children and literary events to promote interesting books and book readings. Recently we had a book reading by Rajiv Malhotra, who's publication Being Different talks about Hinduism in a different light, and about the scholarly misinterpretation of Hinduism in the US. Biggest thing that Kitab Khana's philosophy is to promote Indian literature, also Indian languages. So we have probably the largest stock of Marathi, Hindi, Gujarati, Sanskrit books in our store, and we're always looking for different avenues to promote these languages. The books that are selling well this week are Murakami IQ84 and Catherine Boo Behind the Beautiful Forevers, which is based on the life of a Mumbai slum that she has documented. In the future, we are looking forward to receiving Mumbai Noir, which is a collection of stories of Mumbai authors. And in the windows, we are displaying Handmade in India, which is a beautiful collection of work, craft of across India. And we also have The Extras by Kiran Nagarkar, who's a Mumbai-based author. In the shop window, we have the book Handmade in India, which is a beautiful coffee table book, which has been in a bestseller for the last few years. We love to promote Indian art, craft. Also, lots of children's workshops and events and beautiful children's books, which we source from Tara and Tulika and Pratham, which are small publishers in the children's field. So we also are planning in the summer months to have workshops for children on literary thinking and writing to promote a new generation of writers.
And that was Amitra Somaya from the Kitab Kana bookstore in Mumbai. Interesting, Andrew, that they really do put the spotlight on local writers, local art. That is the difference that makes people come to bookshops instead of buying online, isn't it?
Yeah, and the interesting thing is you often get told that people in Mumbai don't want to read, you know, kind of tales about the slums, or they don't want to look at the dark side of their city, that in fact that's a kind of a Western preoccupation. But suddenly you hear that, a story about the slums and living in the slums is a bestseller there. So it's intriguing that actually people are really engaged with what's happening in their own city, and that they're buying a lot of kind of urban literature, as it were. Mm. And I thought it was great. I also like the fact that as we've cut from each city, you can tell a little bit about the kind of culture, because there you could hear a bit of aircon going in the background. There was almost a fan overhead, I think. And when we were in Madrid, we had the kind of Café Con Leche being drunk in the background.
And we've had sax music from New Orleans. Yeah, there's a soundtrack to these bookstores.
Yeah, there's a subtle story that happens in the background there. Now, next on the review, we're going to hear some music from Spain. We're heading back there again. This is going to be picked for us by the editor of Mondo Sonoro, who's called Joan Luna. So stay with us.
Every month, Monocle deploys over 70 writers and photographers to over 50 countries to deliver our print edition. Covering a unique mix of global affairs, business, culture and design, Monocle publishes 10 magazine editions a year and 2 special newspapers during the summer and winter holiday seasons. With a subscription to Monocle, you'll not only be the first to receive the magazine, you'll also be invited to special events and receive our iconic tote bag from Rutote of Japan. Subscribe to Monocle from £80 sterling at our website at shop.monocle.com/subscriptions. Subscribe to Monocle and keep an eye on the world.
For the latest Monocle news, previews of upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop of all our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com. Let's stay in touch.
Hello, you're listening to The Review on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Gillian DeBias.
It's time now for our weekly music review, and today our focus is on Spain. Joining us on the line from Barcelona is Joan Luna, editor of Mondo Sonoro, a Spanish music magazine. Welcome, Joan.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well. I wonder if you can start just giving us a little sense of what Mondo Sonoro is.
Ah, well, first, I'm sorry because my English is not the best one. I hope you can understand most of my commentaries, yeah?
Absolutely.
Okay, Mondo Sonoro is something like a free magazine. We are on the street since October 94, yeah? And I can say that we can be considered like something like, I don't know, can be something like the New Musical Express from UK, but in Spain, something similar, yeah?
And Joan, can you tell me, you're being successful in print, or do most people visit you online? Do you put out records yourselves?
Yeah, well, the thing is, we are something like well known, because we are a paper magazine, yeah? But since something like 7 years ago, we have something like a very active website. And we have people from both sides, from the internet and from the paper magazine. We are really popular, I think, here because we are the magazine more interested in Spanish bands. Yeah, we have covers in the past for a lot of bands from the States, from UK, etc. But it's possible that we are the most interested magazine in Spain that talk in about Spanish indie bands, yeah?
And Joan, can you tell me, I know that you're based in Barcelona. Now, often when a magazine comes out of Barcelona, they are actually more interested in, say, Catalan music than Spanish music or more Catalan culture. Is that the same with you? Do you have a big focus on what's coming out of Catalonia?
Well, obviously, our headquarters is in Barcelona, yeah, and this makes to us to be more focused in Catalan bands. But it's not really important if they sing in English, in Catalan, in Spanish, yeah. Obviously, talking about the language, when one band sings in Catalan, yeah, it's really easy for us to understand their lyrics, to understand their universe or something, and it's possible that we can be the first people in Spain that write about these bands that sings in Catalan. But it's now in this moment, I think it's quite amazing that most of them, like Manel or Mishima or bands like this, are now popular around Spain. I think it's amazing because a lot of people cannot understand lyrics for real, but they have something like a special connection with their music too. Yeah.
Tell me, is this a good time for music in Spain and indie music? And is there one city that's really leading the way with good new music?
Well, I think it's a really good moment for indie music in Spain because I don't know how to tell you. For example, in the 90s, yeah, we have a lot of bands that most of the records don't sell really any important quantity of copies. Most of the records sound really shitty. Sorry that I use shitty, but they sound really shitty. And I think since the last 7 years or something like this, records in Spain looks more professional, yeah? Good mm-hmm. sound. And people, for the first time, understand that our bands have something like a special kind of taste, yeah? And I don't know how to tell you. It's something like... sorry.
No, it sounds good. So, Joan, why don't we do a little less of this and hear what you actually like? So why don't you pick your first song and just tell us who the band is?
Okay. I picked the first song that is from a band from Barcelona called Stand Still. I think I picked this song because I like the song, obviously, and because they are something like a real example of a real indie band that starts playing hardcore music, really hard, really screamo music, and they do something like a big evolution. And the last record, this record that we'll listen to it now, is something like three records album, yeah, three CDs album, that something like a conceptual record about when you miss your dad and you must start a new life or something like this, yeah?
Okay, well, let's have a listen to it now.
Me voy a inventar un plan para escapar hacia adelante con este sol. Pero ven,
ven. Well, we like that, Joan. That was good. And what's also nice about often in a Spanish record, you get quite a lot of clapping in the background as percussion.
And dogs barking.
That was great, Joan.
Sorry, I don't understand your question now.
No, it wasn't a question, it was more a statement. I like a bit of clapping as percussion in the background, it was good. Now, for your second song, what's the second song you're going to choose for us?
The second song, I think, was from a band from Catalonia called Manel, yeah? It's something like a name. It's like you have a band called Peter, for example, yeah?
Okay.
Manel is a name from Catalonia, and I think the song is La Canción del Soldadet, that means something like the soldier song. And the special particularity about this song is something like a song singed in Catalan, that is another language, not Spanish, and it's something like a traditional history from Catalan tradition, yeah? I think that Manel is one of the best bands now. They sing in Catalan, as I told you before. They are quite popular around Spain now in the indie scene, and it's quite amazing because they sing in Catalan, yeah?
Okay, great. We will cut now to Manel.
Escolteu la cançó del soldadet,
que a través d'un ull de bou veu que volen uns fons. Ja cobert els homes resen. Ja cobert els homes resen.
I fa una ment. Joan, that was great as well. That was Manel. So can you just tell us, how long have Manel been around? Are they a new band or an old band?
Well, this is something like four years ago. This one is the second record. And they were really popular with the first one too, yeah?
And if a band is successful in Catalonia, a Catalan band, do they have a chance to be successful elsewhere in Spain? Or does it mean that they're quite restricted where they're popular?
Well, I think in the indie scene they are quite popular, but I think they have something like success around Spain, because I think all the media in Spain, all the music magazines or something, are in Catalonia, yeah? And we write a lot about Manel, about how interesting they are, and I think people can read this and start to try to listen a band that can sing in Spanish, in Catalan, sorry. And the thing is, they like it, and I think it's really good.
And to become successful, do they play at festivals? Do they play at small venues? Is it radio play? How do you become successful?
Well, it's something like, to be successful in the indie scene in Spain means, for example, Manel in Barcelona, they play for 5 or 6 days in a place for, I think, 1,500 people or something like this.
That's quite a lot of people. Now, we're going to go for the very last track now, Joan. And could you tell me, our producer says that this one might be a little bit more unusual. Who is the final act?
Sorry?
Who is the final act that you want to play for our listeners today?
The final, do you mean something like
your last choice?
Okay, sorry. The most popular in the bands in Spain now are Love of Lesbian. Yeah, the name is quite French, but they are called Love of Lesbian. Another one is called Vetusta Morla. It's a name in Spanish. And Lori Meyers. Yeah, these bands play in all the big festivals in relationship within the music, yeah? And they play, I don't know, for example, in Madrid, Love of Lesbian play for, they are from Barcelona, but for example, in Madrid, they play for 4 days in something like 2,000 people, wow, or something like this. And it's quite big.
Joan, I know another song that we've got lined up here is Manos de Topo.
Okay, this is a quite amazing band. This is in this moment they are more popular than ever. The song that we will listen is for the third record of the band, yeah? And it's something like a special band, because you can like it or hate it, because Miguel Ángel Blanca, the singer, sings in a really strange way, yeah? And this is the thing. Okay. You can like his voice or hate his voice.
Let's see what we think after this.
Escapar con el apagón y volver pelirroja.
I quite like that. I don't mind man with a high-pitched voice.
I don't know. I thought it was a little bit of a parody, so no, my thumb's down for me, I'm afraid.
Oh, well. One of the nicest things about old Joan was that when he told our producer how to pronounce his name, he said it's Joan as in Joan Collins. So for the editor of Rock magazine, I think that's quite good going. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24, and we're back in a moment.
Culture with me, Robert Bound, wants to beckon you onto its intergalactic spaceship of artistic endeavour, zooming you from gallery openings on Mars to concerts on Venus via magazine launches on the outer reaches of the Milky Way. Actually, that's a lie, but it is a truly global mix of art, literature, film, music, media, and the home of the wonderful and well-loved showcase for live music, the Midori House Sessions.
In the backs of buses across Europe and Latin America, maybe compose a little song.
Tune in to hear The Skinny on the finer fringes of culture.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Mercedes-Benz.
Welcome back. It's Saturday and you're listening to The Review with me, Gillian Tobias, and Andrew Tuck.
Now, every Saturday here in Midori House, we pick some of our favourite magazine titles to rifle through. To help us dissect them, we're joined in the studio this week by Chris Ying, co-publisher of McSweeney's and now the editor of their new quarterly food journal, Lucky Peach. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, can you just tell us a little bit about Lucky Peach? How long has it been going and what's its kind of remit?
Sure. Lucky Peach, we're on our third issue. It is ostensibly a food magazine, although, you know, there's enough fiction and cussing and art and things like that to make it not entirely an appropriate food magazine.
How did this come to be? It was born out of, I gather, a newspaper from McSweeney's? What's the background to
The sort of long and short of it was in 2009 at McSweeney's. At McSweeney's, if you don't know, we do a quarterly fiction journal. And for our 33rd issue, we decided to publish a newspaper, a full broadsheet, 300-page newspaper, sort of like an ode to the form. And in there was a food section. And my background before magazines was in food. I was a cook for 4 or 5 years. And I had tried as hard as I could to desperately, you know, separate food from my work. I didn't want to mix the two. And then someone said we'd do a food section in the newspaper. And naturally, I had to take over it. Mm-hmm. And long story short, I met David Chang and Peter Meehan, who are the authors of the Momofuku cookbook. David Chang is the chef of the lauded Momofuku restaurant empire. And for a year and a half or 2 years after that, we sort of tried to figure out a way to work together again. And then this opportunity came up to make a magazine, and we sort of leapt at it.
And we're editorial meetings over food, I imagine.
I think just so our listeners know the territory we're in, you've kindly brought in the new issue. And on the cover, there's a pig's butt being tattooed.
Yeah, there's a pig's butt being tattooed. We've entered into pig butt territory.
It's a good place to be, I hear, on the newsstand.
Yeah. I think that it breaks the cardinal rule of magazine covers, which is don't put a pig butt on the cover.
Well, because most people say you need a face to kind of look at you and connect with your eyes, but you think the pig butt does that.
Yeah. No, I think it's a little gruesome. Although, you know, you could make a whole argument about if you don't know what your food looks like before it's been cooked, then, you know, you shouldn't really be eating it or whatever. That's not really why it's on the cover. It's on the cover because I don't know if this is a trend in the UK or not, but in the States, a lot of cooks have this sort of machismo, like macho fetish with pigs and pork. And so that's translated into this, trend to get a pig tattoo on your arm or your leg or whatever body part. And it's like a meat cut. And so our cover has a pig leg or a pig arm getting tattooed. And that's a real tattoo. It's like a real tattoo artist doing it with a human meat cut diagram. So, you know, like a little sick and twisted revenge fantasy, like a pig getting a human meat cut tattoo.
Now, I know that you're not in the kind of the Condé Nast world of publishing, but what's interesting is that some of those big publishers have pulled out of printing food magazines. They found, you know, famously, Gourmet disappeared off newsstands in the US a couple of years ago. As big publishers thought that it was too tricky to do a food magazine. Now, do you think that, I wondered if that's partly true because, you know, 20 years ago, if you made a food magazine, it was probably aimed at a woman. 30 years ago, if you made a food magazine, it was aimed at a woman who was probably a housewife. Now, actually, the people who cook and enjoy food, it's so much more complicated. It can be a guy, it can be a woman. Do you think that it's opened up the market, actually, for a title like Lucky Peach because we just need a better array of food and drink magazines?
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, you know, food has become such a cultural, like a pop cultural thing. Food is its own sort of, you know, it's up there. People fetishize it and look up to it and admire it and sort of digest it like music or art or books. But I don't think that that's necessarily opened it for a better food magazine necessarily. I think it just means that there's more room because you've got people who are interested in food now who are not only ever interested in food, they were interested in music and art and fiction and poetry and things like that. And so, you know, food is like this primal thing that we all crave, but you know, you've always, everyone's shopped at the grocery store when they've been hungry and just been sort of over the top and put too much stuff in their basket, and you get home and you eat something and you don't care about food anymore. And so like that's something we wanted to avoid with Lucky Peach, which was I'm interested in food until I've had a meal, in which case, like, at which point I don't care about food at all.
You know? I mean, McSweeney's really celebrates the written word, and I gather you wanted this to appeal not just to people who are really into food, but also people who love good writing. Can you talk a little bit about the kind of articles you've
Yeah,
put?
Definitely. I mean, we basically just took the mantra at McSweeney's, which we've always had, which is, you know, to let writers do what they want and let them have as much space as they need to do it.
Dangerous, no?
Yeah, it's very dangerous, especially when your own editor turns in a piece at like 40,000 words and you have to cut him in half. Sorry, Peter. But yeah, you know, it's we like to give text a lot of space. We love to give art full pages and as much room as we can and try to keep the production quality high. And yeah, you know, we try to introduce as many different formats as we could. We had a recipe in haiku form in the first issue, and we ran a Junichiro Tanizaki short story, and, you know.
There is a sense of fun as well. I remember in the issue I first discovered, there was a whole page of, like, sticky fruit labels with irreverent messages on them that you could stick on other people's fruit.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know, in a grocery store, you know, the fruit has little stickers on it with a little code so that the checkout person can punch it in and ring up your fruit, and we decided to commission some artists to make some confusing ones. And we actually got pulled off some newsstands in America because people had started taking the stickers and placing them on the fruit, and just ridiculous.
And can I ask you who you think your reader is? Because it's interesting. I think we've got some of these magazines here that we've pulled in for you to look at. There's one here from Germany called Beef. Now, a bit like the thing you're talking about with the pig, there seems to be a lot of food magazines where there's a lot of knives, a lot of big pans, a lot of men on horseback hunting the boar down before that. So, you know, first catch your pig, then start cooking. Right. Do you think that there is a kind of a male audience for these magazines now?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I don't know who our audience is, obviously. you know, that's part of not being a real company. You know, it's just like not knowing how.
Don't give too much of the game away.
Right, right. No, but I think that, you know, I think what you're getting at is like it's a little bit more of like a masculine aesthetic than some of the other magazines out there.
I'm just going to rifle in front of you.
For
Beef. I'm sorry.
I'll just be like a Foley artist and make the sounds of.
Okay, because I thought this is kind of a typical Beef article. This is from Germany. So they've done a nice spread on how to cook your goldfish,
right.
which seems to me the kind of like the new kind of genre of food.
You have
cooking.
To describe that to our listeners.
Well, there's a whole spread, and there's probably about 50 goldfish that have obviously been hoiked out of an aquarium somewhere and kind of laid down. And
it looks more like Damien Hirst, no?
Yes. And they've got some that have been deep fried and battered. Do you think that there is, I wonder if there is a bit, you know, I know you, Anthony Bourdain is involved a little bit in the background with you. Is there a bit of kind of dare involved in food now? I know that we talked about the idea of reconnecting with where your food comes from, but I wonder if it's becoming almost a bit too bloody in a way that, you know, it has to be, you know, it has to be about blood and guts and first kill your animal.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say this. And, you know, qualify it with the fact that all three issues of this magazine have had dead animals on the cover, which is, you know, maybe disqualifies me from commenting on this. But yeah, I think that...
Does your goldfish look nervous when you walk in the room? That's what I want to know.
No, his name is Finnegan, and he's perfectly safe.
For now.
And, I think that... We really want to avoid that sort of voyeuristic, you know, food as a dare, or like how bizarre can you get? And I mean, again, there's a tattooed pig on the cover, but, you know, that's not really interesting to us. And I do think that's a little bit, you know, has kind of gotten a little played out. And I think that as much good as I really think that Tony Bourdain has sort of changed food writing in some really great and large scale ways. But he also did introduce that sort of, you know, can you eat genitalia and things like that? So I think everybody's sort of shying away from it a little bit now.
Well, that's your starters of Chris Ying. We're coming back for a big main course of him. All right, after this.
The Menu is Monocle's delectable food and drinks program with me, Markus Hippi. On the menu, you'll find out about delicious edibles and mouth-watering drinks. We traverse the globe in search of the pioneers, making a stir amongst the food connoisseurs. We hunt down the wonderful and, sometimes weird, tasty trends that are making a buzz in the food industry.
We've been sort of traveling and collecting stories and collecting projects. So one of the things we hope to do is to connect all these narratives across these different geographies.
Milan to Tokyo, Buenos Aires to Auckland. Each week we send our correspondents to the far-flung corners of the world. We pop into independent bakeries, butchers and wineries to find people passionate about what they make. From French cheese to Bulgarian wine, from Japanese chocolates to South African caterpillar snacks. The Menu premieres every Friday at 1900 hours GMT. Join us for a drink where everything is on the menu.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
And welcome back to Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Gillian De Byers. And we're with Chris Ying, who's talking food and much more, and food and publishing. So, Chris, we were talking earlier on about the Condé Nast model of the glossy titles for food, and you've deliberately gone for a matte stock piece of newsprint for yourself. Was that something, a really deliberate decision to kind of move yourself away from those titles? Or was that all you could afford?
No, it's a little bit about economy, and it's also just about preference. You know, we like that sort of feel to it, and it feels a little bit more permanent. But honestly, since the beginning of Lucky Peach, we haven't been really ever compared to the smaller food magazines, to, you know, Gastronomica and things like that. It's always sort of been Lucky Peach is a reaction to Condé Nast and a reaction to Bon Appetit and Food and Wine and Savour. And it's really not. And I actually had... I spent the last 2 weeks ago, I spent 10 days in China with Andrew Knowlton from Bon Appetit. And I got a really new sort of sense of what it is to work in a glossy food magazine. And it's confirmed a lot of my suspicions, which were that, you know, they're very professional and know what they're doing. And we
I like that. Don't you love it? That's a suspicion. Yeah. I'm really suspicious they might be quite professional.
There was a slim chance that maybe we were also professional, but that was not the case. No, but it's just a very different paradigm. And you know, the latest issue of Bon Appetit, for example, has this tastemakers photo spread, and it's like 8 or 9 really elaborate photos. And I think, you know, I'm maybe like letting the cat out of the bag on some inside whatever, but it was like the most expensive thing Bon Appetit had ever shot on, you know, as photo. And you know, when we went to China, like, I don't even know why I was there. They just happened to think it would be a good idea for me to come with them, and so like, they had that, you know, they paid for me to go out there. They also had a photographer who was shooting everything on film, not digital, because, you know, 35 millimeter film was going to have a better travel feel to it, you know. And so they were investing in these really elaborate sort of costly measures to make their magazine. And you know, it's not like if an issue costs more, they charge the consumer more. So it's this sort of abstract math that they're dealing with, and it's a gamble that if we just make our magazine better, people will respond in the long run and continue to buy the magazine, and, you know, therefore we'll be able to keep our employees and pay people. And so Lucky Peach is a much smaller scale, of course, but it's also like a very different sort of paradigm, you know, where if we spend more money now, we have to do something immediately to make more money, you know. And, you know, we're not talking about a large company or being part of a large company. And so I both was had a lot of admiration for how much effort goes into every single thing in a glossy magazine like that, and how much sort of hits the cutting room floor, and how many photos you take to get the 3 you see in the magazine. Where Lucky Peach, you know, if we spent 10 days in China, I would, cost wise, we would have to turn that into like 6 issues. We would just have to use that content forever.
Well, I think that's just, in a way, that's the kind of argument here at Monocle, is, you know, that we're an independent publisher as well. And if we're going to do something, in the end, it needs to make money. We can't be one of these publishers who says, oh, you know, we'll spend $10 million on, you know, developing an app this year, and it doesn't matter if it doesn't make any money, as long as we're in that space. I wondered about you and the digital environment. Is that, I hate the phrase actually, digital environment. I don't know why I said that. Apologies. I'm telling myself off. What are you doing kind of with the world of the web? Is that something you're engaging with, or are you sticking with print?
You know, the web-wise, our website is a real garbage pail. It's not anything to
it's all the potato peelings.
Yeah, it's not a thing beautiful yet. But at the outset of the magazine, there was this really idyllic sort of vision that we had, that I was really quite excited about, because like Monocle at McSweeney's, we had always been very hesitant and, you know, resistant to iPads and sort of the digital environment, just because it seemed like it was going to come at the cost of print, that making iPad magazines and things like that was going to somehow kill print magazines. But at the outset of Lucky Peach, this magazine actually began as a TV show slash app. It was like a new idea for an app that, or a new idea for a TV show that the user would sort of control which segments they wanted to watch and kind of explore these things. It'd be still be like an hour of content, like a TV show, but you would watch it in whatever order you wanted. And from that idea, they said, you know, look, we're shooting 3 hours for 5 minutes of content. And there's all this really nice content and really good ideas that, like, you can't, that don't live on an iPad. An iPad is for TV. Like, let's be honest, it's not really for reading. It's for watching videos and things like that. So there are things that print can do that iPads can't. And so I thought what was really going to be beautiful about Lucky Peach was that the iPad was going to be video and television and really beautifully produced segments and things that you couldn't quite capture in print. And then the magazine was going to be really long essays and, you know, these longer expositions on the same topic, but not just like the print version of the video or the video version of the print. It was going to be two separate things sharing resources, but ultimately being made in separate vacuums. And that vision for me was going to be a really neat way to embrace digital, to make digital about video.
It sounds like there's a butt coming.
But, you know.
And it's quite a big butt. Actually, the butt is on the cover of the magazine
right,
as well.
But then I woke up and... No. I mean, it's still an idea that I think can work, and it's just contractual stuff has slowed down the iPad app for Lucky Peach.
It's interesting because David Chang could have, with all his notoriety and his cult following, he could have, if it was about making money, he could have gone the route to be a celebrity chef. And why did he choose to go this sort of smaller independent route?
He, you know, Dave is as successful and talented and smart as Dave is. He's also this sort of tortured artist. You know, he's true to what he wants to do, and like he has been approached, and I think that he could have taken the opportunity to just franchise his restaurant into, you know, Momofuku Noodle Bar Express, and you could
on
have
TV.
One on, yeah, and you could have one on every corner, and he would be on TV selling you, like, dressed as a panda selling you orange chicken and things. But, you know, he I really admire somebody of his success and you know, anybody who's like that, who decides that they want to be committed to doing things how they see fit. And I think that that's like sort of the key for his long-term survival, definitely.
And can we ask, what are you doing here in London? Are you here on a food trail or?
Life is a food trail.
love that.
You know, it's, what am I doing here? Visiting some friends, going over to Paris for this Gourmand International Food Awards. And then, just eating nonstop too much.
And is London a city you know well, or?
No, it's not. This is actually my very first trip to London, and I have no idea what I'm doing.
What's on your list? What are you going to search out
food-wise
here?
After Buckingham Palace. We'll get on a double deck. Last weekend I went to St. John Bread and Wine, and then this evening I'm actually eating at St. John. I heard Fergus was here yesterday.
That's not very adventurous, is it?
No.
We've lost the turf a little bit.
And then we're going back there for breakfast tomorrow.
right. And then I've actually, I mean, the pop-up thing is big right now, right? Is that the sort of pop-up restaurants and street carts and things like that. And so we went to, I have no idea where we were. We were at the Brixton Market last night.
You also did a publication about street food, didn't you?
We did a cookbook with some really close friends of mine who I cooked with for a little while. It was a cookbook called Mission Street Food. And these guys, you know, I will say that they were the first pop-up restaurant in the world. And just a really fascinating story. They have a charitable bent to it. Like the chef, Anthony Mint, was got into food because he figured that it was this luxury market that people were willing to overpay for things. And he said, if people are willing to pay $12 for a sardine, like, they'll pay $13 and I can give a dollar to charity, you know. And so this food truck that had a charitable aspect evolved into three restaurants and, you know, $150,000 in food bank donations. So it was a really fascinating story, and the cookbook is great.
But I think the interesting thing is that food truck culture is actually something is being, everyone's trying to copy it. And I'm not sure if it does export very well, but I know lots of kind of British cities are wondering, can we do it here? Although here, councils tend to be not very happy about you parking your truck on the side of the road.
Right, right.
But it is that is a bit of a food revolution that's kind of coming our way from the States. Is that something you admire, that kind of mobile food culture?
So, I mean, when Mission Street Food started, it began because it was the most convenient way of doing something. He didn't want to rent his own restaurant space. There was a taco truck on the corner, and he walked up to them and said, can I rent this from you on Thursday nights? And they said, sure. And so, you know, that was the beauty of it, was that it was something done out of necessity.
Yeah,
it was spontaneous and useful. And then, you know, I guess like sort of buying a expensive food truck and painting it and then like getting the permits and then parking it somewhere is almost as difficult as just opening a new restaurant. And some of like that simplicity is taken away.
And I guess in the end of the day, there's a limit to how many cupcakes you can eat.
Yeah, exactly.
And because that does seem to be like the majority. We were in New York for an event for Monocle the other day, and there did seem to be a lot of these trucks selling cupcakes.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't know that people liked cupcakes. I don't think people knew they liked cupcakes either.
They're vending machines now.
Yeah,
cupcakes.
Well, Chris Ying, thank you very much. The main course was delicious, so thank you. We'll have you back for pudding another time.
Yes.
Well, that brings us to the end of our Saturday review. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here. Today's show was produced by Paul Noble, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our engineer was Toby Hammond. You can catch the best of the week stories with Jonathan Openshaw on The Curator, which is up next. And don't forget to tune in tomorrow to The Monocle Weekly, which will be on air at 11 a.m. London time with me again, Rob Bound and Hugo McDonald. We'll be talking about Fortnum & Mason's in-house historian, we'll be chatting soap with Yardley's, and we'll be looking at Japanese film and lots more. You've been listening to The Review with me, Andrew Tuck and Gillian Tobias. Have a great weekend.